Hello, and welcome to The Secret Right, Volume 1. For those of you unfamiliar with my work and who I am, my name is Josh Reeves, and I'm a radio talk show host as well as a documentary filmmaker. And back in September of 2007, I began my radio show entitled The Global Reality with Josh Reeves. And on the second show that I ever hosted, I had a guest on my program by the name of Professor Peter Dale Scott. Now, during the course of this conversation, Professor Scott and I talked about, you know, the various groups that are generally held in reverence as being part of the power structure in New World Order-related research. And so we get to talking about the various groups that most people talk about, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission. And during that interview, Professor Scott said, well, you know, there's actually a group that has maintained more power and control now than even the CFR, and they're a more secretive and powerful version of that that is mostly made up of people on the right wing side of things, where traditionally the CFR and the Bilderberg Group have been sort of the left end of the phony political spectrum, as it were. So immediately, you know, things started going off in my mind, because at that time I'd been researching probably, you know, off and on for the better part of 13 years. I thought I personally knew everything there was to know about New World Order research, and this was a group that I had never come across. And so immediately I started going through and doing research and finding all these interesting things, and it began to really shatter my paradigm. Well, here we are in the beginning days of 2009, and I've sort of been on this trek since then of really uncovering the group, finding out who is this group, the Council for National Policy. What do they control? What have they been involved in the past? And what are the implications of a group like this operating in secrecy right in front of our faces? So this film is really a testament. Not only that, it's sort of a diary of the work that I have done in my trek in the almost 2 years now of researching the group and tracking down all the best information I can. We've got a lot of news clips here that go back to the news archives. Some of this stuff has never been seen outside of 20 to 30 years. And so I thought it would be interesting to go through and sort of detail who they are and what they're behind, because this is one of the most important pieces of information in the whole realm of scope of research. If we're going to expose tyranny, we have to expose the entire tree. As I've talked about many times on my radio show, I don't see the New World Order as a pyramid as so much as I do you have a tree, and a tree of tyranny. And every one of these branches on this tree of tyranny is just as important as the other. And as you'll see in this documentary film, you'll start to understand, as I do, that if you can control religion and the military-industrial complex and wars, you can control the people who print the money. So we'll go through and we'll detail who they are, what they've been involved in, as well as showing you what the media will and will not talk about in the realm and scope of this type of research. So sit back and get ready for The Secret Right, Volume 1.
During the production of this film, we scoured news archives searching for news reports pertaining to the Council for National Policy. Due, in fact, to the media blackout imposed by the group, no news archival footage could be found. What we did find were other news stories pertaining to other conspiratorial groups, such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. Watch now in this 1995 news report on CBS News with Connie Chung.
In recent days, we've heard a lot about groups that see the U.S. government as the enemy. But that's not the only enemy they see. Even more suspect is a private group called the Trilateral Commission. It's an exclusive club of business leaders, scholars, and politicians. They meet once a year to discuss world problems. But as Anthony Mason reports, some feel the group's agenda is far more sinister.
In Copenhagen, Denmark, late last month, an exclusive club held its annual meeting. David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger are among its some 300 influential members. But some on the far right say this was more than a meeting. They see it as part of a conspiracy to control the world by a secret society called the Trilateral Commission.
The conspiracy is to have a global government in which the elite will control the entire world, and the unwashed multitudes will have a higher loyalty to the world government than to their own provinces, such as the United States.
Jim Tucker spreads this conspiracy theory in Spotlight, the newspaper of the right-wing Liberty Lobby. He is not alone. Read Pat Robertson in his book, The New World Order. A single thread runs from the White House to the State Department to the Trilateral Commission. There must be a new world order and a world elite in charge of it all. It springs, Robertson writes, from the depth of something that is evil.
It's scary, isn't it?
Even in rural Michigan, in the ranks of the so-called militia, they now believe in the global elite.
The more people that find out what's going on, the longer it's going to take them to come into their new world order and their complete takeover by the banks.
It's a rallying cry that spread across the far right. The United Nations would take over America. The Trilateral Commission would control the world. Just look at its membership, they say. Current and former members include Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Carter. Names like Brzezinski, Christopher, Kissinger, and Schultz. And top executives of ITT, Xerox, Exxon, and Nations Bank.
Well, there are certainly folks there with pretty broad responsibilities.
Charles Heck, North American director, says the Trilateral Commission is hardly secret. You can find it in the phone book. Subscribe to its magazines. It was founded to promote global cooperation.
But this notion of what is happening here is a very misguided notion.
The Trilateral Commission is not a conspiracy running the world. But
author Holly Sklar sees the conspiracy theory gaining momentum.
I think a lot of people, whether it's in the militia movement or the right in general, are just desperately looking for answers. And unfortunately, oftentimes people latch on to the most simplistic answer they're given.
They are powerful leaders, but the conspiracy theory that surrounds them may be becoming dangerously influential itself. Anthony Mason, CBS News, New York.
And so the question that begs to be answered here is why the mainstream media would feel free to cover stories on the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and other quote-unquote conspiratorial groups when there has been a complete media blackout on this group called the Council for National Policy. So in this segment of the film, we will explore now just who is the Council for National Policy, who created the group, and who its members have been throughout the years.
The Council for National Policy was founded in 1981 by the Reverend Tim LaHaye. Conceived as a right-wing counterpart to the Council on Foreign Relations, the group quickly rose to power and influence during the Reagan administration. Initial startup money for the group was provided by Nelson Bunker Hunt, mineral speculator and oil baron, who along with Bill Bright were board members of the Sumner Institute of Linguistics in Dallas, Texas, in which board meetings a Rockefeller business partner like Trammell Crow could rub shoulders with an ultra-rightist like Nelson Bunker Hunt. Bunker Hunt was and is a trustee of ILC, a board member and leading financier of the John Birch Society and a major supporter of the Campus Crusade for Christ and third president of the Council for National Policy.
We're here in Dallas, Texas, in White Rock Lake, and right behind me is the home of H.L. Hunt, the former home of H.L. Hunt, the Hunt Oil Brothers. The father, H.L. Hunt, the eldest Hunt, of course, John Birch Society member, as well as Knights of Malta. He is the gentleman that funded the Wanted for Treason posters of JFK that were put in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, as well as they were involved in the manipulation of the silver market during the 1980s, all sorts of criminality, of course, oil as well. But the one of the Hunt sons of H.L. Hunt, this, of course, this where we are here, Mount Vernon, was their palatial home and estate, and you can just sort of see the camera pan down. Notice it's an exact replica of Mount Vernon that Washington lived in. It's very interesting in terms of the sort of Masonic correlations between the Founding Fathers, the elite, and that kind of thing. And so, in the early 1980s, the Hunt Oil Brothers, of course, with all their money to be able to grow around, they were the top funders of the John Birch Society. Of course, we know the John Birch Society was originally funded and founded by the Rockefeller family,
specifically Nelson Rockefeller. He's the one that came in and put the money up for that. Eustace Mullins and others have covered that extensively. You can go look that up and find that out on your own. But the most important thing about the Hunt Oil Brothers is the fact that in 1981, they put up the money, the startup money, to Tim LaHaye to form the group, of course, the Council for National Policy. And that same year, they were also funding things like the National Center for Ethnology and Eugenics, based in Edinburgh, Scotland. Oftentimes, people are doing research on eugenics. They forget to leave that out. And this is one of the biggest eugenics corporations there is, tied to the Pioneer Fund, Roger Pearson as well. And so only big money could form a group like this. And it's very interesting that when you learn that many members of the Council for National Policy are Knights of Malta members, you go back and find out that, of course, the Hunt Oil Brothers were Knights of Malta members, as well as their father, the eldest son. So that's a very interesting correlation when you look at all the kinds of the people that were Knights of Malta members that would have benefited from the death of John F. Kennedy. If you want to really know the roots of the Council for National Policy, who put up the money, and why they would do such a thing, and why they would operate in secret, it's very important that you look into the Hunt family, Nelson Bunker Hunt, H.L. Hunt, and of course, the home, their palatial mansion, Mount Vernon, right here behind me.
It's also improved today, going up a nickel, but that's a minor change for metal whose price has fluctuated wildly over the past year. Tonight in part two of his special assignment series, Dan Quartz reports on silver and some of the men who were heavily involved in its ups and downs.
When the price of silver shot up toward $50 an ounce last year, Americans lined up in thousands to sell their silver bowls, candlesticks, knives, and forks to be melted down into bullion. Actually, such sales were nothing new. Every year since World War II, silver users have depended on such recycling to provide almost half of the demand for silver. That's because the world consumes far more silver each year than it produces. The difference has to be made up from existing stocks. Some of it goes right back into the same products, such as silverware and jewelry, which was melted down. But a lot more goes into industrial goods. For example, in the U.S., making photographic film takes 65 million ounces of silver a year, and electrical equipment another 37 million ounces. Sterling silverware is number three in the use of silver at 18 million ounces a year. That's what makes silver so different from gold. 40% of all the gold mined each year simply goes into bank vaults as a form of wealth. 80% of all silver is used in industry, and the above-ground supply is dwindling. 7 years ago, Herbert and Bunker Hunt, sons of the legendary Texas oil billionaire H.L. Hunt, decided the chronic shortage of silver made it a good investment. So they started buying, slowly enough at first that the price rose only gradually. But last year, as the Hunts bought more and more, the price skyrocketed, soaring from $9 an ounce to $52 an ounce, an increase of 580% in just 6 months. That made silver as an investment even better than gold, but it also drove up the cost of products containing silver, causing a record rise in wholesale prices. According to James Stone, chairman of the government's Commodities Futures Trading Commission, a lot of people were hurt.
The silver-related industries laid a lot of people off. There were more than 5,000 people who lost their jobs in all of that.
Some users are still pinched at today's level.
There's no possibility of keeping up to it. In 1 week alone, it went up and down almost $48. And it's you can't do that. It's no way to run a business.
But the people who run the silver exchanges in Chicago and New York were mainly afraid that the Hunts would accumulate so much of the available silver that they could set any price they wanted. So they changed the trading rules several times until the Hunts were forced to sell and almost nobody else was allowed to buy.
To put it in the terms of a football analogy, the game starts, the rules are changed, and finally when you get to the last quarter, the referee says only the other side can have the ball.
That drove the price down and cost the Hunts more than $1 billion. And nobody knows how much was lost by small investors who jumped on the Hunt silver bandwagon. In recent weeks, as silver staged a comeback from $16 an ounce to $21, the market has been fueled by rumors that the Hunts are buying again.
No, I'm not back in the silver market, but I still have an investment in silver bullion.
So are the Hunts, who still hold 63 million ounces, worth about $1.25 billion, soured on silver?
I'm as bullish on silver today as I was when I first got in it in 1973. And I think silver is still a good investment.
Losing $1 billion didn't even threaten the Hunt's solvency. But people who don't have their kind of money should never forget that trading in precious metals, gold as well as silver, is a high-risk gamble. And nobody should put in $1 more than he's prepared to lose. Dan Quartz, ABC News, Dallas.
The Bible. Could it be inspired of God to write the future? Who knows the future? What is Bible prophecy? Actually, it's the future written in advance. And how could you write the future in advance unless you had divine insight? Only God could write prophecy.
Prior to forming the Council for National Policy in 1981, Tim LaHaye moved to San Diego, California in 1958. Quoting from the Rolling Stone magazine article, Reverend Doomsday, quote, at that time, Southern California was a hotbed of former McCarthyites, neo-Nazis, and the John Birch Society, a right-wing group so paranoid and extremist that it denounced President Eisenhower as a communist. They all muttered darkly about secret societies, the evil United Nations, and one-world government conspiracies, views that LaHaye would soon make his own. For years, LaHaye spoke at Birch Society training sessions, getting to know many of its leaders in building his ministry in the part of California that 20 years later would be the launching pad for Reagan's 1980 presidential bid. The picture on the left is the cover of the 1999 book, The Power of the Cross, by Tim LaHaye. The one on the right is a centuries-old Masonic symbol and can be seen on an official site of the Knights Templar. Some might mistake it for a Christian symbol, but Masonic author Ray Denslow reveals its true meaning. The cross and crown may be said to be confined almost exclusively to the historical degrees in Masonry, as exemplified in the various orders of the Knighthood of York and Scottish Rites. In Gaul, we find the cross to have been a solar symbol when it had equal arms and angles. To the Phoenicians, it was an instrument of sacrifice to their god, Baal, and to the Egyptians, the crux Anasata was his symbol of eternal life. Was it also a coincidence that LaHaye and his associates set up their pre-tribulation research center in a place that's considered a vortex of occultic power in Washington, D.C.? They were located on L'Enfant Promenade, a street named after the Masonic Pierre Charles L'Enfant, who designed the city in Masonic and occultic symbols. From there, coincidentally, they moved their research center to the Dallas area, another city that is sacred to Freemasonry because of its proximity to the 33rd degree of latitude.
We'll be right back.
we've taken a look at who some of the members of the Council for National Policy are, we'll now, in this section of the film, explore some of the events and the various things that they have been involved in through the years, things such as Iran-Contra, the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the Heritage Foundation, the Bohemian Grove, and then we'll talk about the Reverend Sun Myung Moon and eugenics coming up later on in the film. But going back to what we saw in the previous segment with the various members of the Council for National Policy, it's very important that you do your own research pertaining to these members because, well, for a fact, we just don't know who all of the members are. And the members that we just took a look at have been confirmed either by past membership lists, current membership lists are not available. We have every member list going up to 1999, but the group does not release its member list to the public, nor does it tell where its private meetings that are held three times a year in secrecy are going to be held at as well. So that's one of the most important things. We just don't know who all the members are, and there may be some revelations, and there may be some whistleblowers that may take a look at this information and may be willing to come forward with some names that could give us more pieces of the puzzle. And so it's important that you ferret these names out, you find out who is involved in the group. A lot of these people have admitted, either through their publications, their websites, books, etc., that they were members, and others we've had to go through and find for ourselves. But the information is there, and it's important, as always, that you do your own research. So now let's take a look at more of what the Council for National Policy has been up to all these years.
A recent Senate victory for the Carter administration has set the stage for a presidential visit to Panama. In ceremonies planned for mid-June, Mr. Carter and Panama's Omar Torrijos will exchange documents designed to turn the canal over to Panama by the year 2000. An outspoken Army general who complained not only about the canal treaties but about other national security issues is going to be forced to retire 18 months early. Bill Wordham has today's developments and a background look at General John Singlaw.
Less than a year ago, Major General John Singlaw was ordered home from Korea after a newspaper reported his criticism of President Carter's plan to pull troops out of Korea. Singlaw explained that he had been told his remarks were off the record. The Pentagon censured him, banished him to a desk job in Atlanta, and told him not to speak out again. Yesterday in Atlanta, after giving a speech, the general said this about the president's neutron bomb policy.
The decision not to produce the neutron bomb without some compensating concession from the other side is like throwing your trump card away in a game of bridge. I think it's ridiculous.
That remark was off the cuff. It had not been cleared with Washington, but it was reported. Singlaw today said he had believed once again he was off the record. It was one mistake too many for the Army. General Singlaw returned to Atlanta this afternoon after a quick trip to the Pentagon, where he was advised to retire. He agreed to end his 35-year career on May 31st. General Singlaw is a highly decorated veteran of three wars, and he has an excellent reputation as a combat commander. He has widespread sympathy throughout the military, but today his colleagues were wondering how he could have made the same mistake twice. Bill Wordham, ABC News, The Pentagon.
John K. Singlaw is a highly decorated former OSS officer and a retired major general in the United States Army. Founding member of the CIA, he was also joint founder with Congressman Larry McDonald of the John Birch Society of the Western Gold Foundation, a conservative private intelligence dissemination network precursor to the Council for National Policy. As a member of the distinguished Operation Jedburgh, Singlaw was a part of the three-man team codenamed James. Singlaw was parachuted behind German lines in Europe in order to prepare the French resistance fighters for the D-Day invasion during World War II. He headed CIA operations in post-war Manchuria during the Chinese Communist Revolution, led troops in the Korean War, and managed the secret war along the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam, and worked with the Contras in Nicaragua. Active for 40 years in overt and covert operations, he had private and secret interviews with many military and government leaders worldwide. He personally knew William Casey, Director of Central Intelligence during the Reagan administration, as well as Oliver North, and was also extensively involved in the Iran-Contra affair, training the Contras and the Latin American death squads.
Singh sat on the CMP Board of Governors in 1981 and was a member of the Council for National Policy from 1981 to 1998. In May of 2002, Newsmax.com reported that General Major John K. Singlob gave a speech at the 2002 meeting of the Council for National Policy entitled The War on Terror. This was the first known use of that phrase, which became the mantra for the Bush administration. In 1984, Singlob assumed the role of chairman of the World Anti-Communist League. The WACL is an umbrella group for Latin American death squad leaders, Hitler collaborators, and followers of the Reverend Sun Myung-moon. Moon's organizations have supported WACL financially and have helped solidify cooperation between WACL and members of the American political right wing. Chairman of the World Anti-Communist League after Nazi collaborator Roger Pearson until mid-1986. The United States Council for World Freedom, which became the World Anti-Communist League's most active branch, was founded in 1981 by Singlob with a $16,500 loan from the Taiwanese branch of the World Anti-Communist League and a general support from beer baron Joseph Coors. In 1984, Singlob headed a Pentagon panel called to make recommendations on conducting military activities in Central America. The panel's report urged the U.S. to emphasize non-conventional counterinsurgency warfare strategies. Under the Reagan administration, Singlob received assistance and guidance from White House and National Security Council officials for his private Contra supply activities. He identified former National Security Council aide Oliver North as his liaison to the White House. Colonel Jack Anderson wrote a series of exposés on the World Anti-Communist League, connecting the group with death squads operating in Latin America, and once again linking them with fascists, this time in Latin America. Singlob engaged the services of J. Peter Grace and Americares to supply arms to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua and was indicted in 1986 and 1988 over activities in support of the Contras. He was also a member of the National Policy Board and of the American Freedom Coalition. These are organizations that have extensive political ties to the Unification Church of the Reverend Sun Myung-moon.
It's been a year now since Congress cut off all American aid to the Contras, but they have been able to keep their struggle going without American official help. They've been getting their money from other sources. Jamie Gangel reports tonight that those sources include some very rich Americans who prefer to keep a low profile.
The Contras say they have struck gold with a small but influential network of individuals and groups that looks like a who's who of conservative money in America. Among those helping, Nelson Bunker Hunt, the Texas mineral speculator, Joseph Coors, the brewer, H. Ross Perot, the industrialist, and Lou Lehrman, a New York millionaire.
Not only do I think it's appropriate, I think it's necessary and just that private citizens should support those who seek to be free abroad.
The Contras are grateful.
We could not have done it without American private support.
Calero adds they could not have done it without retired General John Singlob, a staunch anti-communist and 35-year military intelligence veteran who was relieved of his command in South Korea for publicly challenging President Carter's policy there. In cash and supplies, Singlob has helped raise at least $10 million in the United States and another $10 million in foreign countries, primarily from Central and South America, but also from South Korea, Taiwan, South Africa, and from Israel by way of Guatemala. Other groups have sent another $40 million for humanitarian aid, which includes boots and uniforms for the Contras. Many of these contributions are tax deductible. All these activities, Singlob believes, are tacitly endorsed by the Reagan administration. And Singlob says he regularly contacts friends at the Pentagon to tell them what he's doing.
So far, no one's sent me a signal that I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I take that as indirect encouragement.
And there are politicians like former Treasury Secretary William Simon and former U.N. Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, who, with the Reverend Moon's Unification Church and its newspaper, The Washington Times, are raising another $14 million.
We need not stand in fear and trembling of helping others fight for their own freedom.
But according to American law, fighting for freedom does not mean that Americans can supply the Contras with weapons. But Contra leader Calero says that some American contributors are trying to get around that.
They make it a point. Someone will write down and say, this is to buy a rifle or this is to buy weapons for your people to defend themselves.
Congressional opponents of private funding say that's a dangerous precedent and against the law. It is also evidence of how difficult it is to monitor what money is being used for, whether it's called humanitarian or military. Jamie Gangel, NBC News, Washington.
A CBS News New York Times poll out tonight shows that 59% of those polled think President Reagan is lying when he says he did not know that Iran arms money was going to the Nicaraguan Contras. This is a new high since we started asking the question last December. This week's telephone poll of more than 1,300 adults also shows that well over half of those questioned believe the congressional Iran-Contra hearings are being fair to the Reagan administration. Week three of the hearings focused on the Contra cash connection, and Eric Engberg has our Saturday sum up.
Have you asked Mr. Osborne?
The committee has clearly established that in the secret operations overseen by Oliver North, money was handled in unorthodox ways and funneled from one project to another long before the decision was made to divert Iranian arms profits to the Nicaraguan Contras.
Was there any further...
In the irony of the week, the committee learned that North had solicited the Contras for a contribution to finance one of his schemes for freeing U.S. hostages in Lebanon.
Now, you gave Colonel North the $90,000 in traveler's check.
Yes, sir.
In the mystery of the week, the committee found by tracing the checks that North cashed more than $2,000 worth of them himself while making purchases at such places as food stores, a woman's hosiery shop, and a tire store.
There were two snow tires purchased with that. When was the last time it snowed in Nicaragua?
Well, sir, it does not snow in Nicaragua.
I didn't.
However, I'm sure there is an explanation for that, and Colonel North...
I hope there is, Mr. Clare.
Other questions about finances were raised when a group of wealthy private citizens testified how North assisted them in donating large sums to the Contras. Financier William O'Boyle and beer maker Joseph Coors said they were told their money had been used to buy light airplanes. Richard Secord, who set up North's secret air supply network, claims the planes he used belong to the companies he controls. One of his managers once proposed selling the network's assets to the CIA at a price in the $4 million range.
I didn't give this money to General Secord. I gave it to the freedom fighters in Honduras.
North has not discussed the money questions and is not expected to until he testifies next month. Among the things the committee will ask about is a plan found in North's White House safe. It was prepared by a Washington-based arms dealer, and it proposes the sale of U.S. goods abroad to finance the secret purchase of arms for anti-communist guerrillas. The plan was presented to CIA Director Casey, but rejected. It incorporates many of the same ideas, including the use of Israel to provide a cover story, that were used by North in the fund diversion just a few months later. Eric Engberg, CBS News, Washington. Attorney General Edwin Meese said today Nicaragua is offering refuge to terrorists from the PLO, Ireland, Italy, Spain, and West Germany. He told the American Chamber of Commerce meeting in Vienna that Nicaragua was becoming a terrorist country club. And right-wing activist Phyllis Schlafly is doing her part to make Christmas merry for the U.S.-backed rebels trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. The group she leads, the Eagle Forum, is sending the Contras what it calls Freedom Fighter Friendship Kits, containing disposable razors, chewing gum, and breath mints, and packed in camouflage pouches.
The Council for Inter-American Security was founded in 1976 and played a pivotal role in formulating Washington's program for counter-revolutionary war and mass murder in Central America during the 1980s. Larry Pratt was a central figure within the CIS hierarchy, as was Patrick Buchanan. Pratt was secretary to the group while Buchanan functioned as an organizational director. But the CIS was more than a new right think tank researching and formulating foreign policy for the Reagan administration. The group functioned in a dual capacity, as an alarmist public policy institute and a domestic spy ring, a privatized version of the FBI's infamous COINTELPRO operations. Having staked out Latin America as their geopolitical niche, the CIS targeted Central American solidarity activists, progressive clergy, and the Salvadoran exile community. The group gathered intelligence and disseminated disinformation, funneling data on foreign policy opponents to the FBI and the intelligence service of the Salvadoran Death Squad state. Many of the state-sanctioned criminals who sought to subvert democratic processes in the U.S. and overseas were connected to a network which included, among others, the John Birch Society, the World Anti-Communist League, the Christian fundamentalists and Catholic theocrats, anti-Castro terrorists grouped in Alpha 66 and Brigade 2506, the LaRouche Organization, and the Unification Movement of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. While such groups operated secretly, they did so with the knowledge, financial backing, and encouragement of powerful American corporate and political interests, some of which we saw in the previous segment. Larry Pratt stated in his 1990 book, Armed People Victorious, based on his study of citizen defense patrols used in Guatemala and the Philippines known as the Contras against communist rebels, patrols that came to be known as death squads for their murderous brutality. Larry Pratt served as an executive in Howard Phillips' U.S. Taxpayers Party. At its 1994 convention, the USTP sold a paramilitary manual entitled Principles Justifying the Arming and Organizing of a Militia. In short, it is a manual that prepares the recruit for underground war. Furthermore, it was at Estes Park that Pratt spoke to the assembled fanatics and convinced them that the armed vigilante death squads that had worked their poison in Central America and in the Philippines could become the model for an armed militia movement within the United States.
Evening, our person of the week. The man we have chosen this week clearly thinks of himself as a gladiator. During yet another week when the tide has been running against the president because of the Iran affair, this man was doing his damnedest to make it different.
I think, Peter, it is fair to say that Ronald Reagan on Friday of this week has far more public and vocal defenders among his own people and among his own parties than he had Friday of last week.
Patrick Buchanan is the director of the White House Communications Office. He's never been shy about throwing down the gauntlet. He began the week by doing battle in the Washington Post, swinging in all directions at anyone who criticized the president.
As director of communication, I do some directing, and this week I decided to do a little communicating.
Buchanan also wrote that if Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North broke the law by diverting funds to the Contras, it could be justified because of a good cause. And Buchanan was in full flight before Cuban Americans in Miami. He's the fastest and brashest talker in the Reagan administration.
If Colonel North...
Yes,
if he ripped off the Ayatollah...
Si él llegó a la Ayatollah...
And took $30 million and gave it to the Contras...
Y le quitó 30 millones a la Ayatollah y se lo dio a la Contras...
And God bless Colonel North.
He ought to be fired for this view that... High officials have a responsibility to break the law when they personally think it's in the interest of our country.
I think Pat Buchanan has filled a vacuum in the Republican Party, saying things that others have lacked the nerve or the imagination to say, and rallying the president's core constituency.
Buchanan learned the White House trade under President Nixon. He was the one who urged Mr. Nixon not to visit Coretta Scott King on the first anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. It would look, said Buchanan, like an endorsement of Dr. King's civil disobedience. He is a loyal man. He stayed in the Nixon White House until the sad and bitter end. Buchanan was born and raised in Washington, D.C. He was educated by the Jesuits, who have never shied away from political involvement. He was a scholarship student at Georgetown and the Columbia School of Journalism. Buchanan says the Jesuits taught him to think. Is he dangerous or just another voice in the debate?
He knows exactly what he's saying, and if he's not, and he is saying it on purpose. So my question is the president letting him say it on purpose? And until something else happens, our assumption has to be yes.
Welcome to Crossfire.
Though his childhood ambition was to become a conservative commentator, which he certainly did, he has long had disdain for much of the press.
A B-1 fight over Russia is a suicide mission. Doesn't
so is a B-52. If a B-1 suicide, a B-52 suicide, and yet you're putting those kids in B-52.
Now, you know the old saying, an Irishman's heart is never at peace unless he's in the middle of a fight.
Buchanan gave up his columns and his broadcast to serve in the White House for the president's second term. And he certainly never stopped working for the conservative cause.
The war between that pervasive modern tyranny that is rooted in communist ideology and free societies, which are built on Judeo-Christian values, is a war to the finish.
He has long been controversial, and he loves every minute of it. Buchanan may or may not stay in this White House until the end. He wanted to be America's ambassador to NATO. The Secretary of State would have none of it. So what will he do next?
I enjoy journalism.
I enjoyed the column, I enjoyed television, and I enjoyed radio. That's my first vocation, and I'm sure one day, the Lord willing, I'll be back at it.
And so we choose 48-year-old Patrick Joseph Buchanan. He is exactly where he wants to be for now, at the heart of power and in the middle of a good fight. That's our report on World News Tonight.
A suggested blueprint today for the Reagan administration from the Heritage Foundation, an influential conservative research group. Included in that blueprint, a cut in minority programs, use of food as a weapon in international affairs, and a revival of international security committees. The House Committee, formerly known as the Committee on Un-American Activities, received prominence in the early 50s with the McCarthy hearings. Reagan aides said they will consider this report, but declined to be specific on its impact. Conservative groups like Heritage Foundation were sharply criticized by Senate Democratic leader Robert Byrd today. He charged these groups are more powerful when people don't bother to vote, and they could, according to Byrd, destroy the political system. Byrd also leveled some very tough criticism at his own party, as Tom Pettit...
Our job is to take back self-government from the courts. We do not believe in being ruled by an elitist group of judges who really think they are supremacists, really think they are supreme over the other branches of government and us. And my book is a book that you can understand even if you're not a lawyer. In fact, if you are a lawyer, it'll teach you things you didn't learn in law school. And it's a way to engage the public. I hope you'll start study groups and book clubs. I hope you'll get the talk shows to engage in these subjects so that the American people understand what the court decisions are doing to our culture and our way of life, and that what we the people can do about it. As we're told in Isaiah, they wait upon the Lord, will rise up with wings like eagles, and they will run and not be weary. And there's no reason to be depressed today. We've taken over politics before. We can do it again. And it depends on you this year. Thank you.
NBC News in depth tonight, conspiracy theory, as we've heard Hillary Clinton today raise the allegation that the accusations of a sexual scandal aimed at her husband are being driven by a right-wing conspiracy to bring down his presidency. As NBC's Lisa Myers tells us in depth tonight, it's certainly not the first time this tactic has been used.
The First Lady's salvo appears to be a favorite Clinton tactic, fired off in almost every scandal from Jennifer Flowers to Paula Jones to Whitewater.
The never-ending fictional conspiracy that, honest to goodness, reminds
guys who the conspiracy.
So all of these charges are tainted with the stench of partisan right-wing politics.
They've used it over and over again. It's the politics of demonization.
Demonizing the president's accusers helps rally Democrats and distract attention from fresh charges against the president.
In Clinton's case, the conspiracy strategy often works, partly because there is indeed a core group of conservatives who consider this president unfit for office and are hell-bent on proving it.
They operate anti-Clinton internet sites. One video, promoted by the Reverend Jerry Falwell, even accuses the president of murder and money laundering. The White House wants to portray the latest scandal as a cabal between Paula Jones and her conservative lawyers, a literary agent who spied for Nixon, and a former White House employee who has accused Clinton of misconduct before. Then there are the so-called chief conspirators, independent counsel Ken Starr and the federal three-judge panel that gave him the green light to investigate, a panel the White House says is driven by politics.
The same three-judge panel that is headed by someone who was appointed by Jesse Helms and Locke Faircloth.
Both conservative Republicans and both close to head judge David Sentell, a former Republican activist. But the judicial panel also includes Kennedy appointee John Butzner and Nixon appointee Peter Fay, often described as nonpartisan. As for Republican Senator Faircloth, today he scoffed at the idea of a right-wing conspiracy.
Instead of Ms. Clinton raising her antenna and circling the country to find the source of her problems, I think she can look at her own family and she'll find them right there.
Neutral observers say the president has given his critics too much ammunition.
Bill Clinton has handed the right wing one 2x4 right after another with which to beat him over the head.
Tonight, Starr has his biggest 2x4 yet, and conspiracy or not, many conservatives are cheering him on. Lisa Myers, NBC News, Washington.
He rolled out even heavier artillery, giving voice to a theory she has believed for years.
This vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president.
She has the critics pounced. She would have been far wiser earlier in this game to take the baseball bat and work him over for all women, because what he has done is inexcusable, and she has allowed him to continue to do it.
If an American president had an adulterous liaison in the White House and lied to cover it up, should the American people ask for his resignation?
Well, they should certainly be concerned about it.
Should they ask for his resignation?
Well, I think that if all that were proven true, I think that would be a very serious offense. That is not going to be proven true.
I never told anybody.
Make them prove it. That, in a nutshell, is the president's strategy, delivered by the woman who once again is not just standing by her man, but working to save him. Jonathan Alter, NBC News. The Council for National Policy played a key networking role in promoting anti-Clinton activism and developing impeachment strategies. In September 1994, the group mailed copies of the Clinton Chronicles video to all 500 or so of its members with a cover letter urging them to pass it on to a friend, relative, business associate, public official, or member of the media. The Citizens for Honest Government's Impeachment Organizers Kit explains that the impeachment resolution introduced by Bob Barr was conceived at an impeachment panel discussion during a CMP Montreal meeting in June 1997 and a follow-up discussion in South Carolina. The resolution itself was introduced in November. While many strands of the anti-Clinton network lead back to the CMP, this disclosure is the first documentation that the CMP has played a central behind-the-scenes role. On page 128 of his book, The Meaning of Is, Bob Barr openly states that the plan to impeach Bill Clinton was cooked up at the 1997 meeting of the Council for National Policy. This is a key piece of information when you understand that the engineered demonization campaign against the puppet Bill Clinton had to be ensured so that their puppet George W. Bush could be installed in the 2000 elections. Ken Blackwell is the former Ohio Secretary of State and former Ohio gubernatorial candidate. Blackwell and former Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay co-founded the Coalition for a Conservative Majority, the CCM, in November 2007. In mid-March 2007, Blackwell hired on as a senior fellow for family empowerment at Washington's premier right-wing religious lobbying outfit, the Family Research Council. In the 2006 congressional election, Blackwell ran against Ted Strickland, 6th Congressional District Democrat incumbent, who was giving up his seat to run for Ohio governor. Strickland defeated Blackwell by 23 percentage points. Ohio voters sued Blackwell on August 31, 2006, in a case called King Lincoln Bronzeville Neighborhood Association versus Blackwell, in which individual voters and three voters' rights groups alleged that in his capacity as Secretary of State, Blackwell allocated 2004 election resources in a racially discriminatory manner and instituted racially discriminatory procedures for provisional voting, purging voters from the statewide voter registration database, and maintaining the chain of custody of ballots. The complaint alleged that these actions led to the dilution and or cancellation of plaintiffs' votes due to ballot cancellation and tampering, long poll lines, mechanical difficulties with voting machines, and unclear precinct boundaries. The complaint claims that plaintiffs reasonably feared these problems would reoccur in November 2006 and then asked the court to appoint a special master to perform Blackwell's election administration duties in that election. This photo of Ken Blackwell addressing the Council for National Policy was posted on his website in 2006 and then subsequently removed. Blackwell is considered to be the main on-the-ground man for the Bush election fraud of 2000 and 2004. On Election Day 2004, he met in Columbus with Bush and Karl Rove to solidify plans for winning the Buckeye State's 20 electoral votes, which turned the election to Bush. Blackwell's extremely controversial handling of the election and the vote count had prompted widespread belief that it, too, was stolen. The results ran counter to the historically accurate exit polls, and Blackwell has stonewalled three successive court battles against public scrutiny of the results and has resisted a verified accurate recount. While serving as Secretary of State in Ohio, Ken Blackwell enacted laws prohibiting anyone finding vote fraud in the state of Ohio to be unable to contest the vote no matter how much evidence is found. With no one ever taking the White House without ever taking Ohio, many believe Ken Blackwell to be the main suspect in the 2000 and 2004 election stealing for George W. Bush.
Ken Blackwell hopes to bolster support for his candidacy for governor in the backyard of his opponent, Ted Strickland.
But riding along with Blackwell on the tour is a gun rights advocate, getting attention on his own. On State House correspondent Dan Weist reports.
Trailing in campaign cash and most public polling, Republican gubernatorial candidate Ken Blackwell started a 3-day bus tour into the heart of his opponent's home territory.
Hey, ma'am. Good to see you. How are you doing?
Blackwell is making 11 stops in southern Ohio, including much of Democrat Ted Strickland's current congressional district, which has a conservative bent. Here, it's Chillicothe at an art store. It's a rally and a fundraiser with mostly the local GOP.
It's a hard year for Republicans, yes, but every election is a hard year, and we know best how to make this work.
Also on this bus tour is a somewhat controversial gun advocate. Some of his critics say that this man shouldn't be on the bus tour at all.
I simply cannot understand why Ken Blackwell, or any politician for that matter, would want to be on a bus with Larry Pratt.
Liberal-leaning groups, like the director of Progress Ohio, say Larry Pratt has ties to extremists and ultra-conservative hate groups.
You've got somebody here that would make a difference, certainly on the gun issue.
Pratt is director of Gun Owners of America, a Virginia-based gun rights group. But Pratt and Blackwell say his advocacy is not about hate.
I know him to be a stand-up fella. I know him to be a person who is a true defender of Second Amendment freedoms.
Both Blackwell and Strickland have received endorsements from gun rights groups. Both candidates in the month remaining will be hitting the highway to pick up or retain supporters wherever they can. In Chillicothe, Dan Weist, the Ohio News Network.
More land for peace. Joel 3:2 says, any nation that tries to get Israel to divide my land, I will bring it into judgment. I want those of you in the State Department and in government in Washington to hear this. If America does not stop pressuring Israel to give up land, I believe that God will bring this nation into judgment because I believe what this book says. And if God brings this nation into judgment, he will very likely release the terrorists that you've already let get here through the ridiculous immigration policy he refused to stop. And this nation is going to go through a bloodbath that you have permitted because of what you have done. You have disobeyed the law of God.
Devastating consequences await those who violate God's word. God, he says, may already have sent Hurricane Katrina to punish the U.S. for its role in helping Israel remove Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip.
I want to ask Washington a question. Is there a connection between the 9,000 Jewish refugees being forcibly removed from their homes in the Gaza Strip, now living in tents, and the thousands of Americans who have been expelled from their homes by this tremendous work of nature? Is there a connection there? If you've got a better answer, I'd like to hear it.
Back in Washington, CUFI delegates were briefed on what the organizers now consider the defining issue, the challenge of radical Islam.
At this very moment, there are evil men who worship death. It is a sick philosophy that goes by many names, but I haven't found a better name than Islamofascism because it summarizes what we are up against.
The Islamofascists have Israel in mind as an appetizer. We are the main course.
The difference, my friends, between Israel and the Arabic world is a difference between civilization and barbarism. It's a difference between goodness and evil. And this is what we're witnessing in the Arabic world. They have no soul. They are dead set on killing and destruction.
Brigitte Gabriel was one of the most popular speakers here. Her American Congress for Truth is devoted to fighting the spread of militant Islam in America.
Here's what we're doing. We're taking cities and states and organizing them into chapters. We are appointing people to monitor the media in your local community, your local newspaper that is anti-Israel, anti-America.
Gabrielle is a Maronite Christian from Lebanon. She called on the Kufi delegates to keep their eyes open for the enemy within.
Another thing you can do is monitor universities. Monitor what the professor is saying about the Middle East policy and our foreign policy. The students cannot challenge their professors because they get bad grades. But you can. It's your job and your civic duty to do so. Another thing you can do, if you know there is a suspicious mosque in your community or suspicious Islamic organization, find out who owns the deed to that mosque. Is it some Saudi sheikhs or Islamic sheikhs outside of America? Write their names down. Come home. Call your local FBI office. Turn the names to them. This is how they can start monitoring them. Israel's enemies are our enemies.
Choose the book, either one you want to do. Now, you stay right with me. The national debt. Just write that, national debt. The debt that we are in as a nation. First of all, Americans are like sheep. They never ask themselves questions. If we have a national debt of $6 trillion, it would be interesting to know who we owe. And you ever ask yourself that question? Well, the national debt. Well, what is it? Who do we owe? Where did we get the money? What did we borrow it for? What's the interest rate? Who are we paying back? We don't know. We just go on. Listen to this. The national debt in 1901 was $1 billion. One. It stayed there until World War I, and it went up $25 billion after World War I. A jump from $1 billion to $25 billion as a result of one war. 1942 to 1952, it went from $25 billion to 72... No, excuse me. Let me start over. 1918 to 1941, on the eve of World War II, it had gone from $25 billion to $49 billion. 1942 to 52. It went from $72 billion to $265 billion. From 1962 to 1970, it went from $303 billion to $383 billion. From 1971 to 76, from $409 billion to $631 billion. From 1990, from 76 to 90, it went from $631 billion to $2 trillion. You know that a trillion is 1,000 billion. You understand that? I don't want to get these numbers so big to you that you don't understand. Let me break it down for you. In 1990, the national debt was $2 trillion. As of today, you have to get it every day. As of today, it's $6 trillion from $2 trillion. $6,795,955,074,699.99. That's what we owe today. To whom? To whom do the citizens of the United States of America owe $7 trillion? Wait, it's growing. Are you ready? It's growing $1,006,000,000 a day. How's it growing if we're not borrowing anymore? Thank you. But your Bible doesn't call it interest. Your Bible calls it usury. I dare you to touch somebody and say, you're using me. Oh, uh-huh. See, when that banker comes along and says, but it's just us and so interest, you ought to look right back at him and say, you're using me.
No. You're gonna feel heat right down there. You put your hand down in your abdominal area, and you're going to feel the heat of God right now.
No. You're going to feel heat right down there. You put your hand down in your abdominal area, and you're going to feel the heat of God right now.
Jesus. just going down right now. Others with infection, the Lord is taking away the infections. Just receive the Lord's infected tooth. Very serious, and it's all swollen, and you're having continuous problem with it. God has just reached in and healed it by the power of God. Continuous problem with it. God has just reached in and healed it by the power of God. Continuous problem with it. God has just reached in and healed it by the power of God.
Continuous problem with it. God has just reached in and healed it by the power of God. Continuous problem with it. God has just reached in and healed it by the power of God.
Results are in today from the first statewide referendum of its kind on pornography. By more than 2-1, voters in Maine said no to a law providing fines and jail terms for dealing in pornography. But Maine's answer comes amid new questions nationwide about pornography, and it comes just before the Reagan administration releases a controversial study that will add more heat to the pornography debate. Bob Schieffer reports.
For a year now, the commission appointed by Attorney General Meese has been making a triple X-rated survey of the business of sex in America, wrestling with questions that have vexed people almost since the Garden of Eden. What is pornography, and is it harmful? They found no shortage of horror stories.
John would sit watching television and reading these pornographic magazines with my 2.5-year-old daughter and me in the room.
For sure, erotic movies, tapes, and the like are America's new growth industry. This is a trade show put on by adult filmmakers. It looks just like the trade shows staged by people who make boats and appliances. Of course, people who make dishwashers don't get asked for autographs. The report the commission will publish next month won't define exactly what porn is, but concludes it's a big problem.
I think there is a much more universal perception in this country that pornography is definitely harmful to individuals and to society.
Commission critics concede there is a lot more sexy stuff around, but they charge the commission was formed simply as a political payoff to the administration's right-wing fundamentalist supporters, and that the fix was in from the start.
It's a witch-hunting commission. The attorney general appointed a commission to get a preordained result.
In fact, the commission conducted no independent scientific studies, but using available data will report next month it believes violent pornography does cause violence. The investigation was not marked by bashfulness. After hearing testimony critical of Playboy and Penthouse magazines, the commission sent letters to some businesses selling them, saying they'd been branded as porn. Shortly after, 7-Eleven stores pulled the magazines from their shelves. Some other stores are now polling customers about what to do. Playboy's Hugh Hefner couldn't believe it.
If magazines, like movies, were rated, Playboy would wind up being somewhere between an R and a GP.
The sound and fury over Playboy has drowned out some serious commission findings, among them that more and more child pornography is turning up.
I saw photographs confiscated from molesters of little children that I will never forget. I can't get that out of my head.
Even many in the industry agree that something has to be done about child porn and violent porn. But critics say that in its zeal, the commission has really hurt itself by trying to tar everything from Playboy to kiddie porn with the same brush.
The Meese Commission is so excessive and so bizarre, the mainstream of America is going to be speaking out against it.
Whether it does or not, erotica has become so commonplace that the people who make sex films now openly hold their own version of the Academy Awards, and it hardly causes a ripple. This happy winner, Best Actress. Bob Schieffer, CBS News, Hollywood.
In Montana, two members of the Freemen who surrendered to the FBI yesterday were arraigned today. Ebert Stanton and his mother, Agnes, pleaded not guilty to 51 counts of conspiracy and fraud. Ebert, who's also charged with armed robbery and threatening public officials, has been ordered held in prison. His mother was released, but she will remain under house arrest. ABC's Jack Smith has more on the Freemen tonight and a measure of the extremism that drives them.
When Agnes and Ebert Stanton gave themselves up, that brought to 4 the number of people who voluntarily left the ranch in less than a week. Evidence that so far the FBI's low-key approach here is paying off.
But there are still about 20 people out at the ranch, including a hard core of extremists held together by a potent ideology of white supremacy common to many hate groups, some of them here in the West.
One of the most outspoken freemen in the compound is Rodney Skirdall, a former Marine who has written extensively about what's called the doctrine of Christian identity. The doctrine holds that Jews and blacks are inferior. It is the colored people and the Jews, writes Skirdall, who are the descendants of Cain, and when we move into a new land, we are to kill the inhabitants of all the other races. According to Christian identity doctrine, the descendants of Northern Europeans are the real children of Israel. And since the land belongs to them, they don't have to pay taxes and the government can't foreclose on their property.
They are the chosen people of the Lord. The promises given to Israel in the Bible are the promises given to white people.
Local pastors have had extensive run-ins with Skirdall and other freemen.
What's driving them, and the lens through which they see all of life, is informed by their Christian identity beliefs, which has actually nothing Christian about it.
Virtually all of the people of Jordan reject Christian identity. Pastor Helen Young visited the freemen just before the standoff began.
See the strength of their convictions. It almost panicked me.
And some here believe the virulence of those convictions makes it unlikely that in the end, everyone inside Justice Township will leave peacefully. Jack Smith, ABC News, Jordan, Montana.
Then we're going to take a quick look at just a couple of examples of controlled opposition. Now, this is the idea of putting two of their own people out in a public forum to debate an issue and to give the impression and basically the public facade that these individuals that are documented involved in some of these same groups, like the John Birch Society, the Council for National Policy, the Knights of Malta, etc. And we have a few examples. If we went into any more than that, it would be hours and hours worth of footage because there's just so much of this. But it's important to note when you see these things happen in the media, on talk radio, etc., because it happens so often, it's almost impossible to document. But it's one of their favorite tactics because what it does is it gives the impression that these two individuals are divided, and thus it divides and conquers the individual and the person that doesn't know any better. So we have two examples. One is of Larry Pratt along with John Ashcroft, and this is concerning when the Patriot Act came out. Now, we know from looking at past member lists that John Ashcroft and Larry Pratt are both members of the Council for National Policy. We also have a picture of a letter sent to Mr. Pratt by John Ashcroft on his own letterhead with his signature, as well as a clip from the 1980s with Crossfire with Tom Brayden, Pat Buchanan, and Larry McDonald. Now, Larry McDonald took over as head of the John Birch Society after the death of Robert Welsh. And, of course, Robert Welsh was trained by the Jesuits. He got his initial startup money and funding from Nelson Rockefeller. And he also was the one, you know, he passed the torch on to Larry McDonald. And then, of course, when Larry McDonald died in Korean Air Flight 007, the torch was then passed to John McManus, who was also Jesuit trained. Every head of the John Birch Society has been Jesuit trained. As we saw in the previous clip, Pat Buchanan, as well as Jesuit trained, and Larry McDonald and Pat Buchanan are both members of the Council for National Policy. So in the clip that we're going to watch, you'll see that they're basically arguing over the John Birch Society and the CFR and calling it conspiracy theories when Pat Buchanan knows full well about these groups, and they're really just attempting to divide and conquer the individuals and to keep the citizens divided on individual issues instead of looking at who's really in charge and who's really pulling the strings up on high.
Crawford, Texas, where President Bush is vacationing, a coalition of anti-war groups rallied today against U.S. policy in Iraq and the controversial Patriot Act. Congress passed the anti-terrorist bill after the 9/11 attacks, but now even some of the Bush administration's usual supporters are saying the legislation goes too far. Attorney General John Ashcroft has begun a month-long tour trying to build support for the law. ABC's John Cochran has more.
We are winning the war on terror.
And, says the Attorney General, the United States would not be winning without the Patriot Act.
Ashcroft is taking his carefully planned public relations campaign to more than a dozen cities, but they are only a fraction of the 153 cities and towns that have passed resolutions criticizing the Patriot Act. Groups usually friendly to the administration, such as the gun lobby, are suddenly hostile.
This is an amazingly dictatorial, totalitarian bill. The Attorney General should be ashamed of himself. We're fighting terrorism, not the American Constitution.
Many conservatives have now joined liberals in charging that the law gives the government too much authority to snoop into what books people buy or borrow from libraries, to inspect personal and business records, to secretly search homes and businesses without immediately notifying those under investigation. Worried about invasion of privacy, the Republican-controlled House stunned the administration last month by voting overwhelmingly to stop secret searches of private property. Now, some conservatives want to go further and remove other provisions in the Patriot Act.
Free citizens should not acquiesce in giving government too much power, power that can be misused.
Alarmed by conservative opposition, the Justice Department has even set up a website defending the Patriot Act.
Our Patriot Act allows our expanded teams to connect the dots, to put the entire picture together in order to save lives and defend liberty.
Conservative opposition comes just as the administration was hoping to expand its investigative powers. Instead, Ashcroft is fighting to keep the power he has. John Cochran, ABC News, Washington.
That's a pretty important quotation.
It's all right. It was made in a pamphlet by a fellow who later headed up a society. Let's say it was a dumb statement. The first society was formed in 1958. Why are you all now, the John Birch Society, still answering for a statement like that? Why didn't the Birch Society say, look, our founder made an asinine statement, we don't pay any attention to it, and go on to the future? Why is the John Birch Society, in his phrase, now considered by an awful lot of people who will say, okay, Jerry Falwell, moral majority, new rightists, okay, don't like them. But all of a sudden, when you mention the Birch Society, everybody recoils. Why is that?
The reason is, Tom, of course, we haven't gotten into what the society is. Instead, we have tried to, it's a sort of a classic effort of a straw man that's thrown up where the society never took a position. The society never stated anything about Eisenhower one way or the other. It was never a position of the society.
Was it a problem for the society that its head for 25 years was the man who had made that statement, and his head is not that now?
Well, part of the problem is, Pat, the actual statement has not been quoted.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone wants to take the time to read the politician with the footnotes, they can maybe read it and judge for themselves. But that's not a position one way or the other of the society. And, of course, another small problem is that Mr. Welch did not resign. Actually, this was a move of transition of leadership, of which he was one of the individuals in actively making the transition. He has emerged as a chairman emeritus.
Were you hurt then? I want to get to the point why the John Birch Society is differentiated from other new right organizations. You can say Conservative Caucus or NCPAC or Conservative Digest, and people say yes, no. But you say the Birch Society, and there's a recoil. Even among conservatives who will say, no, don't call me a member of the Birch Society. Now, why is that? Is that partly due to the fact that Bill Buckley's National Review, I think around 1964, read the Birch Society out of the conservative movement? Have you recovered from that?
Well, I think Bill Buckley founded ACU in 65 partly to do that. Elements within National Review have also, beginning in 65, I think very dishonestly, took a very strong tack against the society. The society would actually be termed more of the old right. I think the definition of the new right would be vigorous.
Okay, but why? I mean, I don't know where you disagree with the new right people, but why do you carry around this tarnish, this taint?
Well, let me give you another reason why you carry around the taint.
I'd be glad to give you the answer.
Mr. Welch.
The reason is because the Society is the only organization in America that is organized at the grassroots level with paid coordinators, with chapters in the communities all across the country.
Conservative caucus.
Not with chapters, not with a paid field staff for all across the
but
country.
That's organization.
And so the result is that this is the one group, I think, that those who would radically change America seriously fear. And a tremendous campaign was launched in December of 1960.
Right.
To move to discredit the John Birch Society and, frankly, launched Michelin orders coming out of Moscow.
Well, Mr. McDonald, I'm not a conspirator. I think even Buchanan would vouch for that.
Robert Wells,
I don't think so. Yeah, I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Is that a conspiracy?
Well, let
me just tell you what Newsweek says this. The John Birch Society considers communism only one arm of a master conspiracy in which socialist American insiders are plotting to establish world government. Now, it also says, and here's Director John McManus, that's your public relations director, saying that former Secretary of State Alexander Haig and CIA Director William Casey are two of these master conspirators who are plotting to establish world government. Now, what do you, that kind of silly, asinine statement is what makes people laugh. That's the John Birch Society.
Well, Tom, I'm sure being a longstanding member of the Rockefeller apparatus, and as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations of longstanding, you're fully aware that there is an elitist core in this country that has seen value in subsidizing communism, of protecting communism.
It has?
Sure.
You're accusing me of subsidizing communism?
No, I'm saying
because
that.
Because I happen to belong
There is an elite core in this country that has dominated American society.
Well, I'm not one of them.
The Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations.
State Department, I suppose.
Well, let's face it, they've dominated the State Department for 40 years, and pretty much openly.
All right,
so.
But what are they trying to do?
Well, their objective is to try to bring about a gradual transition in our society, a dissolving of sovereignty, and a moving steadily to the left on the political spectrum.
Well, who are they?
The elitist groups that I mentioned, particularly key individuals and policymakers in the Council on Foreign Relations.
Is the International Monetary Fund part of this?
Well, I would say the International Monetary Fund has certainly been set up for the purpose of facilitating that transfer of sovereignty and transfer of wealth on the road.
Right, we elected Mr. Conservative.
Let me just finish the point, because otherwise we're going to have a lot of unanswered questions. That you are looking at a group that has worked to bring about the dissolution of national sovereignty on the road to world government. And certainly you're familiar with local professor Carol Quigley, who has been part of your club, in which he admitted all this. And he said in his book, Tragedy and Hope, the only thing I disagree is that we've worked to keep it a secret. And you see Arthur Schlesinger Jr. writing way back in 1947, says, yes, this is the hidden policy of America. But we can't tell the American public because they're too unsophisticated to see the value.
What is the instrumentality of world government? What is the instrumentality?
Of all the things you say about Arthur, that's the silliest statement I ever heard. He never made anything like that.
Well, let me suggest that you read the May-June issue of the Partisan Review of 1947, Tom, and you can read it for yourself. It's called
Arthur Schlesinger said there was a conspiracy.
Oh.
A conspiracy to promote communism?
Oh, no, he didn't use the word conspiracy. He said the objective was to bring
about...
Well, let me finish. I'll tell you. He said that the objective, the secret policy, which we can't tell the American public because they're not sophisticated enough to see the value, is that through a steady result of erosion of new deals, we bring the American society steadily to the left,
right,
and through a fine concept of benign containment, we merge into the vital center of the socialist left. Those are his words, not mine.
You think John Kennedy was a member of that conspiracy?
No, let me ask you this. The world federalist movement in the post-war era contained a lot of people who eventually broke with it, and a lot of people thought the UN, in the post-war era, looked toward world government. Indeed,
sure.
They did, up until 48, 49. But a lot of them said, look, we were utopians. That's over and done with. We can't move. And a lot of them came in Kennedy's government. Schlesinger was in there when they were fighting in Vietnam, launched the effort in Vietnam. Schlesinger was behind the Bay of Pigs. In other words, look, isn't there some move that occurred in the post-war era that now has been dissipated because nobody believes in the utopian ideal of world government anymore?
Well, I think there are those that realize that moving straight from a prototype of the United Nations into world government perhaps is tactically impossible. But phasing out increasing the national sovereignty into regional government and phasing out sovereignties into international treaties in multiple areas
The whole movement toward, quote, interdependence.
Yes.
NATO is part of the conspiracy?
Well, there are certainly elements in NATO. There are people in NATO that are very strongly dedicated to the defense of the West. But at the same time, you find in NATO a steady dissolution. You find a growing weakness. There's a NATO policy dominated by State Department policies that has not worked.
Well, it's a regional grouping, and I think, therefore, it may be suspect by the John Birch Society.
We're talking with Congressman Larry McDonnell, who has recently been elevated, I guess, to chairmanship of the John Birch Society, succeeding Robert Welch. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to Crossfire. Our guest is the new chairman, recently named chairman, of the John Birch Society, Congressman Larry McDonnell, a Democrat from Georgia. Mr. McDonnell, your predecessor believed that the PTA was too left-wing and that and the John Birch Society at one time tried to infiltrate it, or so he said. He used the word infiltrate. Is that part of your program now?
Well, I think when the PTA comes out in this program for the test ban treaty, and when the PTA comes out for gun control, and comes out for obviously national legislative programs that have been linked with liberaldom, having nothing to do with education of our children, I think many people are wondering what in the world is the PTA doing, and that includes members of the John Birch Society.
Well, I wonder about you. I wonder about you. I looked you up. You're the biggest joiner that I've ever seen in the world. You belong, as I counted them, to 67 organizations, among which are the National Rifle Association, the American Pistol and Revolver Association, the Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, the Second Amendment Foundation, and the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms.
Well, Tom, I think there's a real drive in this country to try to destroy the realization of our citizens that they have a fundamental constitutional right to keep and bear arms as the Constitution allows. And unfortunately, there are those in our society, including elements of the PTA nationally, not always locally by any stretch, but nationally, who would believe that the federal government should restrict the right of citizens to keep and bear arms.
Can I get back to that?
What kind of grades do you give Ronald Reagan as president? And what kind of grades does the John Birch Society give him?
Well, I would say in his speeches, Pat, you'd have to give him close to an A, B plus to an A. But in his performance,
what's most disappointing?
Well, I think the fact that the rhetoric is going one way and the record is going another.
Let me ask you about this conspiracy again.
Well, you can take the issue of one of the major problems of this country is inflation,
right,
and the problems of the destruction of the dollar. And the fact of the matter is, in spite of promises of the contrary, Reagan has not moved to correct the deficiencies. We're now back to Keynesian economics, despite comments to the contrary.
Do you think that's a result of the conspiracy you mentioned? Is there somebody working on them to get the inflation so that this country will be weaker?
Well, as a man who campaigned against elitism, as a man who in his campaign rhetoric said that he would not be having the Council on Foreign Relations trilateral types dominating his cabinet, he's got about 250 members of such in his administration.
Well, let me ask you about Bill Casey. Now, I've known Bill.
250 members.
I've known
of the trilateral committee.
I've known Bill Casey
in the administration.
I've known Bill Casey, the director of CIA since World War II. As a matter of fact, in World War II, he was my boss. Now, you're a public relations director of the John Birch Society, says that Bill Casey is a part of this conspiracy that's trying to bring about world government.
Before he became CIA, one of his big jobs was aiding in the transfer of technology and goods and so forth to the Soviet Union, helping the Camel River Project, the Export-Import Bank. Helping to finance
the Export-Import Bank part of the conspiracy?
I think the fact that the American people have been tapped steadily, especially since World War II, to finance their enemies and to have the massive technology transfer to those who
would do it.
You know that from the Braden Doctrine in the agency, which you're very familiar with. And the feeling that we must somehow subsidize the, quote, non-communist left. So that's among our so-called allies.
Braden was
and in country after country,
left?
That turned out to be the communists,
mm-hmm.
the crypto-communists masquerading
as
non-communists.
Yeah, that's Mr. Mitterrand, who has taken the strongest position against the Russians of any Western European.
Well, he was about to lose everything at the polls, and he had to show some sign. It's very difficult to say exactly how far that will
Congressman McDonnell, he's been using the term conspiracy.
No, I didn't use it. For heaven's sakes, Pat. The John Birch Society used it.
I don't want to go through the tape.
Well, it is. Don't blame it on me. He used it.
You've used it 45 times.
That's right. They say this is a conspiracy. Right. I want to know what the conspiracy is. Yeah. I'm trying to find out who's in it and what agencies of government in it, because I want to fight it along with you.
You look
and
like great, Tom. Let me tell you, Tom.
You tell me, you know, how can I join the John Birch Society?
Well, gosh, Tom, you got no problem at all. All you need to do is write a letter to the John Birch Society, Belmont, Massachusetts, 02178, and tell them that you would like to purchase for $2 a copy of the Blue Book. Tom, you read it, and I think if you're a dedicated American, you will agree with every word. Then you get in touch with me, and we may even sign you up.
Yeah, but it says here in one of your publications, not just anyone can be a Bircher. Now, how can I be a Bircher?
Not just anyone. Now, if you don't believe in the Constitution and limited government and free enterprise and biblical values of morality,
I believe in all those, but
I don't believe
there's a conspiracy.
He'd make a lousy candidate.
As a matter of fact,
a member of the conspiracy, he's a member of the press.
Let me ask you. He's used, and Mr. Braden's used for the 47th time the term conspiracy. Now, let me ask you seriously. When you use people like Casey, who's on the Council on Foreign Relations, David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission, what do you mean? Or do you mean, is that your term, the term conspiracy?
Well, there are many different levels of the problem. But yes, the term has been used, the term of conspiracy, when you have a group of people.
I mean, they're actively collaborating, and at the other end of that point of collaboration are communists, and on this end of the point of collaboration is Bill Casey and trilateralists and
Al Haig.
You have people who are part of the elitist structure of this country that have dominated this country openly for 40 years.
I know, but they're not, is that a conspiracy?
Now, wait a minute. If people quietly working together for evil objectives, two or more, that by definition is a conspiracy. You have, by their own admission, you look at The Tragedy and Hope by Professor Carol Quigley, who's a member of this elitist group. He says, sure, we've been working this. Sure, we've been collaborating with communism. Yes, we're working for a global accommodation. Yes, we're working for world government. The only thing I object to is that we have kept it a secret. And I think we've gone so far along, we should come out and say,
I'll bet you a dollar and a half that Bill Casey doesn't know who Professor Quigley is. I don't.
He's at Georgetown a number of years ago.
He died a couple of years ago, and he wrote The Tragedy and Hope. He's a very noted member of your club, Tom.
Tom, you've got to broaden your reading a little bit.
What I ought to do is read more about conspiracies, and that's why I'm interested in what
I'll tell you what you ought to do is go back and look at your founder, Edward Mandel House, because he wrote the book Philip Drew Administrator. And in this, Colonel House said that what he envisioned for the world was a world government along socialist lines as envisioned by Karl Marx. Now, that's your leader, Tom, so you got to go back to the beginning.
Well, his leader was Woodrow Wilson. Do you think he was a communist?
No, I think Woodrow Wilson was his follower. I think Edward Mandel House dominated Wilson, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. And so Edward Mandel House, that was, we ought to make that clear, he was
Colonel
President
House.
Wilson's principal
alter ego, that's correct.
Yeah. So he is the real villain from which all these conspiracies...
No. He is a major figure, Tom, but there has been, unfortunately, in the West, an element. There are good members in the Council on Foreign Relations, dedicated patriotic people. You've had Sproul Brayton, who was a member of the Council of the Birch Society.
Bill Buckley.
And Council on Foreign Relations. You've got some dedicated people, but the driving forces have very clearly been willing to collaborate, subsidize, work for technology transfer for what they feel is some type of an accommodation and merger. And I submit this would be a disaster for the American Republic.
Are there any in Congress?
Sure.
Our guest is Ben, Congressman Larry McDonald of the John Birch Society. He's the new chairman. He's succeeded Robert Welsh, who has stepped down, as I understand it. Is that correct?
He's been sort of promoted to chairman.
He's been promoted to chairman emeritus and founder. And Tom Braden and I will be back with final comments in a moment.
Pat, I just want to tell you, I think some of the people who served in the Nixon White House are good, clean, upstanding, patriotic Americans. And some of them, on the other hand, are suspect. And I'm just going to have Larry McDonald, the head of the Birch Society, take a look at some of those people, and I wonder if he might find you.
Tom, where I disagree...
There's something going on here.
I disagree with Congressman McDonald is the idea of conspiracy with you and your friends. I think it's more of a herding instinct. The direction you've been moving in, inertia, carries you further and further. But I do think this. That slogan, get the U.S. out of the U.N. and the U.N. out of the U.S. looks better and better every day, doesn't it? Maybe they were ahead of their time on that one.
No, Pat, I think we got to have communications with the world, and the UN makes me mad, too, but I don't think it's a part of the great conspiracy which extends from Bill Casey and Al Haig all the way to communism.
Well, I think that Larry McDonald's a patriot. I think he's wrong about the conspiracy, but he's probably less wrong about what he says about this country than the guy I'm talking to.
Yeah, I think...
One of the interesting facets of the Council for National Policy are the relationship between evangelicals, Christian Zionists, Catholics, Freemasons, Jesuits, the Knights of Malta, all various interlocking groups that all seem to have various different ideologies. You have some men that have been connected to anti-Semitism, to being anti-people of Jewish faith, and you've had other ends that are connected to people who are anti-Catholicism, people who are the Christian Zionist, some of the ones that we just took a look at who are, you know, very pro-Israel. But you find all these members coexisting together with inside the Council for National Policy structure. And so we start to understand that there is a root of the religious hierarchy throughout the world, and really where that lies. So we're going to take a quick look in the subsequent coming sessions at the Knights of Malta, the Jesuits, and some of these people that are involved in the group that fall under that mantle. And hopefully we'll answer quite a few of the questions that people have had concerning these religious affiliations within members of the Council for National Policy.
Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger canceled plans to go to Bohemian Grove in California this weekend because of the possibility of more flare-ups in the Lebanon crisis. But even without the Defense Secretary, the Bohemian Grove will not close down for lack of power. And what is the Bohemian Grove? Well, it's a kind of summer camp for the powerful, an all-male gathering in great secrecy. More from Dennis Murphy.
George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, and West German Chancellor Schmidt arrived by car.
The chairman of General Motors and U.S. Steel came in by private jet.
If you would look at the guest list over a period of 5 years, I don't think there would be anybody of any importance in America who was missing from that list.
Cabinet officers and captains of industry are going to summer camp at Bohemian Grove, an all-male retreat secluded in the Redwood Forest 2 hours north of San Francisco. Outsiders are not invited. What's hidden away is a little bit of Boy Scout camp and a lot of fraternity hokum. There are rituals, bonfires, and the burning of effigies. The members live in lodges with names like Wolf and Caveman. Gerald Ford, Henry Kissinger, William French Smith, and George Shultz are bunkmates at Mandalay Camp.
President Reagan's camp, Owl's Nest, is famous for its Eggs Benedict and Ramos Gin Fizz breakfast. But for the most part, stories about what happens in these redwoods are hard to come by.
A campground statue reminds Bohemians to keep their mouths shut about the grove.
I've heard a lot of good music there. I've met a lot of interesting people, and I look forward to listening to music again.
But there are employees who tell tales out of school.
You know, I mean, half of these guys, you know, from what I can tell, you know, stay loaded or stay bombed, you know, the entire time that they're there. I mean, they stagger into breakfast and stagger out from dinner. But at the same time, you know, they're talking business.
And sometimes those business talks send ripples far beyond the grove. Sociology professor William Domhoff.
Reagan and Nixon talked at length in 1967 in the Grove to decide who would go first in Republican primaries.
While decision makers are cementing friendships, protesters outside the gate are keeping a vigil. To them, the Bohemian Grove is an all-white, all-male, undemocratic policy-making arm of the government. They want the Bohemians to go home. But summer camp won't end until next week. Dennis Murphy, NBC News, Monterrey, California.
And secrecy of another kind, war boots.
This statue depicting the patron saint of the Bohemian Grove, St. John of Nepomuk, a Jesuit who was martyred in 1393 because of his refusal to break the seal of the confessional and divulge the secrets of the Queen of Bohemia to the Protestants. This is an interesting fact because in the Oath of the Jesuits and the Knights of Malta, one of the things that it clearly states is, quote,
I do further promise and declare that I will, when opportunity presents, make and wage relentless war, secretly and openly, against all heretics, Protestants, and Masons. I am directed to do, to extirpate them from the face of the whole earth, and that I will spare neither age, sex, or condition, and that I will hang, burn, waste, boil, flay, strangle, and burn alive these infamous heretics, and rip up the stomachs and wombs of their women, and crush their infants' heads against the walls, in order to annihilate their execrable race.
This fact speaks volumes in light of the secrecy surrounding the Bohemian Grove, and further proves that the Grove is deeply staked in the Jesuit Catholic tradition. Another important icon of the Bohemian Grove is the giant statue of an owl. Commonly misidentified as Moloch, the owl actually represents the Roman goddess Minerva, also known as Athena in Greek mythology. Minerva was considered to be the virgin goddess of warriors, poetry, medicine, wisdom, commerce, weaving, crafts, and the inventor of music. She is also known as the protector of cities and civilizations. This is an important fact in light of the many industry representatives that attend the Bohemian Grove, and also of the fact that an effigy is sacrificed to Minerva to cast away care that members will do whatever it takes to succeed in their particular field. Minerva is also depicted on the state seal of California, home of the Bohemian Grove, and sits atop the Texas State Capitol Dome, which is larger than the Capitol Dome of Washington, D.C. We can now clearly see that these important icons play a very prominent role to the many Knights of Malta and Vatican-tied members, such as those shown earlier that are members of the Knights of Malta. One of the most interesting and controversial figures involved in the Council for National Policy is the Reverend Sung Yung Moon. Founder of the Unification Church, better known as the Moonies, Moon has been the largest financial contributor to the Council for National Policy and the Republican Party for the last 30 years, funding the likes of Jerry Falwell, George Herbert Walker Bush, Gerald Ford, Jack Kemp, Tim LaHaye, Gary Bauer, and more. His paper, The Washington Times, has long been the propaganda arm of the CMP and the Republican Party. Moon, who is also a Knight of Malta, has long worked with right-wing political forces linked to organized crime and international drug smuggling, including the Japanese Yakuza gangs and South American cocaine traffickers. Moon also has extensive ties to the World Anti-Communist League and the Iran-Contra affair covered in previous segments. Moon, who calls himself the King of Peace and the Messiah, claims to use a spirit world device to communicate with dead leaders such as Thomas Jefferson and Hitler, and claims that they have given him endorsements from the grave. Quoting from the Reverend Sung Young Moon,
"The five great saints and many other leaders in the spirit world, including even communist leaders such as Marx and Lenin, who committed all manner of barbary and murders on earth, and dictators such as Hitler and Stalin, have found strength in my teachings. Mended their ways and been reborn as inversions. Emperors, kings, and presidents who enjoy opulence and power on earth, even journalists in that worldwide fame, have now placed themselves at the forefront of the column of the true love revolution. Together they have sent to earth a revolution expressing their determination in the light of my teaching, of the true family ideal.
Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, Pat Robertson, Paul and Jan Crouch, Benny Hinn, Dr. Tim and Beverly LaHaye, and almost everyone else on national TV or radio are financially beholden to Reverend Moon, the self-proclaimed Messiah who believes that salvation comes through him and not Jesus Christ.
Several members of Congress are backpedaling now after it became public that they attended a reception on Capitol Hill, one honoring the Reverend Sun Young Moon. Moon, known for officiating at mass weddings and as being a convicted felon for obstructing justice and tax fraud. He was given a peace award at that reception, a reception at which he called himself humanity's savior, the Messiah, returning Lord, and true parent. Now, many of those lawmakers who were there claim they were duped into attending. Steve Santani, the national correspondent, with a Fox Report Live from the newsroom in D.C. Steve?
Well, Shep, some members of Congress say they had no idea that Sun Myung Moon would be coronated during this event or that he would claim to be the Messiah. Large parts of the March event were posted on a Moon-related website, then later removed. The video shows one member of Congress, Danny Davis of Illinois, carrying a crown that someone else places on Moon's head. Another congressman, Elijah Cummings of Maryland, apparently praised Moon at the event, but today told us the praise was actually for a constituent.
I'm the son of two Pentecostal ministers, and my mother would die almost to think that I would say something like that about Mr.
At the event, Moon claimed he's the Messiah and that his teachings helped Hitler and Stalin to be reborn as new persons. Strange as it was, the House Speaker says members of Congress can attend any event they want.
That's up to every member to make up his decision, his or her decision, on what type of events they're going to be participate in and what the consequences of those events are.
One final note, Shep. Nobody we talked to actually believes Moon is the Messiah.
Steve Santani.
Could I make a statement about national defense?
Yeah.
The biggest threat to America today is not communism. It's moving America toward a fascist theocracy. And everything that's happened during the Reagan administration is steering us right down that pipe.
Oh,
Project Megiddo was a pre-Y2K operation ran by the FBI in an attempt to identify, quote, Christian militia gun owners that believe in a UN-led New World Order takeover conspiracy being implemented in the year 2000. Recent Department of Homeland Security documents have mirrored this plan in the present day. This is extremely interesting in light of the fear-mongering of armed conflict that occurred by people such as Chuck Missler and others prior to Y2K, as the push for armed conflict being engineered today with such figureheads as Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity now declaring the NWO conspiracy to be real. In these times, it is important to have discernment and understand that someone on television saying New World Order is not your ally and is attempting to further keep people stuck in the phony left versus right mindset.
Good evening. Dan is off tonight. I'm Bob Schieffer. Well, the end of the year is bringing a big increase in, of all things, gun sales. And it's apparently being sparked, at least in part, by fear that the coming of the new year will bring a new wave of violence. CBS News correspondent Diana Olick has our report.
Sharon Shand had never owned or fired a gun.
Okay.
Until today.
I just wanted to be prepared in case, you know, anything happens for Y2K, just to have an ounce of prevention, you know.
So this mother of a baby boy asked her father for an old family shotgun and brought it to this Virginia gun shop for a lesson.
We went for protection, so that's really all that we went for.
Sharon is not alone. FBI statistics show mandatory gun background checks this month are up 20% from last December. And last Thursday set the record, 67,000 checks in one day.
It's been an inordinate amount of sales, and the home defense shotguns is been very, very busy. Yeah.
Gun dealer Hayward Long has sold out of most of the guns he recommends for home use.
It may have been the terrorist threats that people are getting concerned about, that taking it serious.
Y2K gun buyers say they're afraid of everything from terrorism to 911 failures. And those fears may not be all of their own making. It seems some dealers and manufacturers are adding fuel to the fire.
The bottom line is that fear sells guns. So for the gun industry, what could be better than the end of civilization as we know it?
Glossy ads have been featuring the Y2K limited edition assault rifle. Survival, it seems, is selling. But at what price?
You know, we're not being invaded. You know who your neighbors are. You know, you really have to have a sensible thought of where does your threat reside. And in point of fact, there's more of a threat to you in your house with a gun that you don't know much about than there is from marauding bands of looters who are responding to the year 2000.
Still, Sharon Shand isn't taking any chances.
What are the laws as far as carrying this gun? Because we're not going to for the evening.
She'd rather be armed than scared. Diana Olick, CBS News, Chantilly, Virginia.
The International Association for the Advancement of Ethnology and Eugenics was a prominent group in the promotion of eugenics and segregation and the first publisher of the Mankind Quarterly. The IAAEE was founded in 1959 and has headquarters in Edinburgh, Scotland, according to researcher and author Russ Ballant, and was later also incorporated into the United States through the personal agency of Lord Malcolm Douglas Hamilton. A member of the British Fabian Socialist Cliveden set, who supported the appeasement of Adolf Hitler prior to World War II. A. James Gregor was a founding director of the IAAEE, which was, according to Gregor, established to restore an intellectual climate in the U.S. and throughout the Western world, which would permit a free and open discussion of racial problems. Gregor would later assert that his association with the organization was based on his concerns about congenital birth defects and the reproduction of the mentally retarded, as opposed to racial matters. Other members included Senator Jesse Helms and the oil billionaires Herbert and Nelson Bunker Hunt. The IAAEE's main benefactor was Colonel Wycliffe Draper, a segregationist who opposed the civil rights movement of the 1960s and sought to fund research that would provide scientific justification for segregation and revived the concept of racial hygiene. In the 1970s, Gregor was criticized for accepting grants from the Pioneer Fund, which had been established by Draper to advance his views. In the controversial book The Bell Curve, authors Charles Murray and Richard J. Hermstein recommend two books on race and intelligence by three Pioneer Fund recipients. The Council for National Policy connects to the eugenics movement through Senator Jesse Helms. Helms was on the CMP Board of Governors in 1982 and was a member in 1984, 85, 88, 96, 98, and 99. Throughout his political career, Helms collaborated closely with two other CMP participants, Tom Ellis and R.E. Carter Wren. In the 1980s, the three CMP participants teamed with Harry Weyer and Marion Parrott to form an elaborate multi-million-dollar network of corporations, political action committees, ad hoc groups, and foundations. According to the Institute for the Study of Academic Racism, the network's leadership, especially Harry Weyer, Thomas F. Ellis, and Marion Parrott, are part of an interlocking set of directorates and associates linking the Pioneer Fund to Jesse Helms' high-tech political machine. In the 1980s, Ellis' Coalition for Freedom, a component of the Jesse Helms political machine, received grants totaling $195,000 from the Pioneer Fund. For many people, it is hard to swallow the idea that the Council for National Policy has ties to the eugenics movement. After all, Council for National Policy participants such as James Dobson, Tim LaHaye, and Alan Keyes are considered to be stalwart pro-lifers. George W. Bush even put in an appearance at a secret meeting of the CMP in 2000, promising to nominate only pro-life judges. There is a body of evidence, however, that suggests that all the pro-life rhetoric and pro-life participants may be mere window dressing to hide the sinister goal of creating a master race. Another key Council for National Policy eugenics player is Roger Pearson, a British-born anthropologist and advocate of eugenics. Pearson was brought to the United States in 1965 by Willis Carto of the Liberty Lobby and contributed to some of Carto's publications such as Western Destiny and the Noontide Press. Pearson also headed the U.S. chapter of the World Anti-Communist League, and President Reagan personally thanked him for his substantial contributions to promoting and upholding those ideas and principles that we value at home and abroad. Pearson also served on the editorial board of the Heritage Foundation and the American Security Council.
On the American Agenda tonight, how smart we are about how smart we are. Tonight, we're going to take a closer look at a furious debate that has been raging in the country for several weeks now. Ever since a new book, The Bell Curve, argued the proposition that intelligence is very much determined by an individual's race, that some races are simply smarter than others. Our Agenda reporter is Beth Nissen.
It is much of what makes us human, our intelligence, our distinct capacity to perceive, to reason and remember, to learn, to know. We know that the complex set of abilities we call intelligence varies between individuals.
Yes, all right.
We are not all equally intelligent.
This is so easy to do.
Not so easy.
Yet most scientists who study the electrical and chemical marvels of the brain say little is truly known about the origin or character of intelligence.
Even though we've made a lot of progress, we're at the foothills of an enormous intellectual mountain range.
The much-discussed new book, The Bell Curve, claims to know a great deal. Its fundamental claim? That intelligence can be measured accurately.
Mental ability is captured reasonably well, as these things go in the social sciences, by IQ tests.
IQ tests.
Try that one.
Millions of children and adults have taken them since the 1940s, answering questions like this one, designed to test logic. In this sequence of numbers, which two come next? And there are questions like this. Define the word taught. Questions that measure language skills. Leading education researchers now say standard IQ tests are far too narrow, that logic and language are only two kinds of intelligence. There are others, including spatial intelligence.
Lock it up like that.
And interpersonal intelligence.
Tell me what a person with interpersonal intelligence does, Susan.
They like working with groups and they're good at being leaders.
We know a lot more about intelligence than we did even 30 years ago. That's not reflected in the intelligence test. They haven't changed materially at all in 50 to 100 years.
But science has. Using high-tech scanners and imagers, neuroscientists like Dr. Eric Kendall can actually see why intelligence is almost impossible to measure. It is constantly changing. The brain, the factory that produces intelligence, is always learning, retooling.
You can actually show an anatomical change, an actual increase in the number of synaptic connections.
Brain surgeons like Dr. Benjamin Carson say the brain responds to everything it experiences from its first formation in utero.
I would have to say that hydration, nutrition, and stimulation environmentally play very large roles in the development of the human brain.
That challenges the most critical and criticized claim in the new book, that while environment may have an effect, intelligence is largely genetic and largely fixed in a person by the age of 16 or 17.
For whatever reasons, whether it's nature or nurture, doesn't make any difference anymore. At 17, that SAT score or an IQ score is hardwired.
And the book goes on to conclude that blacks as a group are hardwired, are permanently set at a lower level of intelligence than whites. Blacks score an average of 15 points lower than whites on those standard IQ tests. Therefore, suggests the book, welfare and job training programs should reconsider spending money to change people who cannot be changed. Yet there is compelling evidence that people can be changed, even evidence based on IQ tests. The U.S. Army gave IQ tests to several hundred thousand recruits in 1917. Blacks as a group scored higher than whites when they came from states with good education systems. Evidence that education matters more than race. Evidence that brains can and do grow intelligence.
This is true for you and me at our respective stages of intellectual development. It's even more true for the unborn child and the newborn child.
That is something we, as intelligent beings, can learn, can remember, can know. This is Beth Nissen for the American Agenda.
There is more to this controversy about intelligence and race. Some of the ideas found in the book, The Bell Curve, are not new. Our Agenda reporter, Bill Blakemore, has been looking into a fairly obscure research fund that has drawn attention because of this book, The Bell Curve. A fund with a history.
Press for the pioneer.
Pioneer Fund. There is no office. The fund's president and four directors avoid publicity and rarely talk to journalists. Ever since 1937, the Pioneer Fund has promoted the study of racial purity as an ideal. Over the past 10 years, according to public documents, the Pioneer Fund contributed $3.5 million to researchers cited in the bell curve. Psychologist Arthur Jensen received $1.1 million from the Pioneer Fund. 25 years ago, he started writing that blacks may be genetically less intelligent than whites. Psychologist Philippe Rushton received $656,000. He says his researchers show small genitalia may be a sign of superior intelligence. Psychologist Richard Lynn, $325,000 from the fund. He has written that incompetent cultures should be phased out. Close to half the footnotes citing authors to support the bell curve's most controversial chapter that suggests some races are naturally smarter than others refer to Pioneer Fund recipients. Historian Barry Mailer charges that the Pioneer Fund's interest in race differences made the bell curve's arguments possible.
The Pioneer Fund has been the key source of funding for the last 20 years of scientists who have produced the material that is the foundation for the claims that African-American people on average are intellectually inferior to whites.
Bell Curve co-author Charles Murray, who declined an on-camera interview for this report, told us that he knew very little about the Pioneer Fund, had never taken its money, and knew of only two researchers cited in his book who had. Nonetheless, the controversy around the bell curve is focusing attention on this obscure fund.
To understand how the Pioneer Fund got started, we came here to Cold Spring Harbor, just outside New York City, where the Pioneer Fund's first president, Harry Laughlin, spent many years.
From 1910 till 1940, this was the headquarters of the American eugenics movement. Eugenics means roughly breeding for good genes. Laughlin wanted the lowest 10% of Americans sterilized to, quote, eradicate inferior people. That did not happen, but by 1931, 30 states had sterilization laws. In the 1930s, together with a wealthy entrepreneur named Wycliffe Draper, Laughlin forged links with researchers in Germany who were also increasingly enthusiastic about eugenics, racial superiority and inferiority. In 1936, the year before they set up the fund, the two men distributed one of Hitler's propaganda films to American high schools. It was called Erbkrank, which means hereditary defective.
You find an especially high percentage of mentally ill among the Jewish population.
Go back to Adolf Hitler and take a look at what somebody who was serious about eugenics did.
As the horror of the Nazi death camps became known, the science of eugenics was discredited. Nevertheless, after the war back in the U.S., the Pioneer Fund, bankrolled by Wycliffe Draper, continued to pay for research in race betterment. One recent Pioneer-funded study, for example, examined the IQ of non-white immigrants. The fund also funnels money to anti-immigration organizations. Its officers and researchers have also fought school desegregation. Professor Michael Levin, who recently got $124,000 from the Pioneer Fund, says black people should be detained under some circumstances simply because they're black.
I don't really say it's so outrageous if, say, a policeman is walking by two stores. He sees three Asian boys go into one. He sees three blacks go into another. And he wants to prevent shoplifting, and he's got to choose which one to maybe walk into, why he couldn't use race as a factor.
Professor Robert Gordon, a fund recipient cited in the bell curve, is writing a book that defends the fund. He argues the fund is misunderstood.
The Pioneer Fund is the last remaining source of funding for people who might be interested in why there are race differences in crime or why there are race differences in poverty rates and who don't adopt the standard sociological line on that.
But many established scientists charge that what the Pioneer Fund pays for is not good science.
I think it's important to realize that most of the people doing this work are not geneticists, and that if you ask people in the mainstream genetics community, you are not going to find much support for this work.
The man who's been president of the Pioneer Fund since the 1950s, Harry F. Weyer, refused to appear on camera. He wrote us that it is the fund's, quote, noble intent to better the lot of mankind, and that the fund's stated goal to promote race betterment refers to human race betterment and has no implications for minorities.
As for the bell curve's co-author, Charles Murray, when we told him what we'd found out about the Pioneer Fund, he accused us of being on an intellectual witch hunt that would have a pernicious effect on research. Bill Blakemore, ABC News, New York.
In a moment, the confession of...
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of the film. And one of the things that I hope you'll take away from this documentary is the idea of doing your own research, digging deep, and ever stopping at one absolute truth. Over the course of the year and a half that I researched this film, one of the things that I came across was the more that I thought I knew what was going on, the more I found out I didn't really know a damn thing. And it's a very humbling experience making a film like this and having to dig deep and dig into the topics that people don't necessarily want to touch, because they start to reveal things about their heroes, things that bring in question people that they have admired through the years. That certainly happened for me during the course of making this film. But I hope that you'll dig deep, and I hope that you'll continue to look into these groups, such as the Council for National Policy, and also the subset groups, and really find out who's really in control. So I highly suggest you look into the Fabian Socialist Movement, find out how these movements 100 years ago, out of the Millers Roundtable and the London School of Economics, and the Cecil Rhodes Scholars, such as Carol Quigley and others, formulated the groups on both the left and the right, such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Council for National Policy, on either side of the phony political spectrum. I also highly suggest you look into the Jesuits. Find out who has been Jesuits inside of government at the highest levels. Find out about the Knights of Malta, the true origins of the Zionist ideologies, and really the importance of finding out who pulls the strings on the puppets. Who are the real puppet masters? So in the coming Volume 2 of The Secret Rite, we will delve deeper into these topics. We'll look at the priest class, the Vatican, and delve deep into who sits on high and who has the power to control and run the world. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, lead no one and follow only yourself. I'm Josh Reeves. Until next time.